There's no question that the Bible is the greatest book that's ever been written. And there's no more fulfilling study in the entire world that a person can do than to study the Word of God, which is the Bible. But there are three aspects to the Bible. There's a spiritual aspect, a mystical aspect, and there's also a historical aspect. Now, if you want to study the spiritual aspect of the Bible, you can read the Bible yourself, go through it. You can also go through it with wonderful, wonderful teachers like Chuck Smith or Chuck Swindoll or David Hawking or Professor McGee. Many people, you can search out the spiritual aspect of the Bible. Then there's a mystical aspect of the Bible that is probably done best studying with people like Chuck Missler. But the historical aspect, if you want to study that through a pastor or something, there's a pretty big shortage, mainly because when you go to church, the church's whole light is on saving souls, which is as it should be, that we want to bring people into a knowing knowledge of Jesus Christ. But once you have that knowledge of Jesus Christ, once you have that saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, and you've accepted Him as your Lord and Savior, and you've read the Bible through, and you're fascinated, you love the Bible, but maybe there's a curiosity, at least there was with me, about these wonderful, wonderful people that God has chosen to reveal Himself through. Wouldn't it be neat, for example, if we could find books that were written by some of the people of Israel that were in the desert under Moses? Or some of the people that were ruled by David or Solomon, live witnesses through books that would tell us how wonderful it was to be ruled by people of God, God's chosen people. But unfortunately, we don't have anything like that. The closest that we come to having any manuscripts of those times, of ancient, ancient times, would be a work that was done by a man named Flavius Josephus about 80 to 100 A.D. Flavius Josephus was a man that was there when Jerusalem and the temple were pillaged and burned by Titus and Vespasian. He was in the camp. In fact, he tried to warn the Jews. He tried to plead with them to give up, to forget it, because they didn't stand a chance. Josephus' life was a perfect preparation for compiling a history, which is what he did. He compiled the history of the Jews out of all of the books that existed at that particular time, which we no longer have today. When libraries were burned at Alexandria and at Rome and at Constantinople, so many manuscripts and scrolls that provided knowledge and information about ancient peoples, especially God's people for my interest, were destroyed, and once they're burned, you never see them again. But this Josephus had access to thousands and thousands of books, scrolls rather, that were in Rome when he was taken prisoner. His life is really fascinating because he was probably born just before Jesus was crucified. So he possibly lived at the same time that Jesus did. We know that he lived at the same time that Paul did. He was also a student of the sects at the time. He studied the Sadducees and the Pharisees and another group that isn't really mentioned in our Bible, but that we know from history exists and through the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they're the Essenes, or I like to call them the Essenes because that's easier to remember. You have the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. Josephus made a study according to his autobiography, of these three sects to see which one was the real truth. He chose the Pharisees, as did Paul before his saving knowledge of Jesus Christ on the Damascus Road. Josephus tells us that the main difference between these three sects was the way that they perceived fate, or God's divine providence in man's lives. It seems that the Sadducees felt that there was no providence, that there was no fate involved. Man is the master of his ship and the captain of his destiny, so to speak, and God does not interfere. The opposite of that would have been the Essenes. They felt that everything was predetermined by God, that God ruled, and that no matter what man did, it could never be anything that God had not already ordained to happen. Now, the Pharisees were kind of in the middle. They felt a little bit of both. They felt that God interfered in man, that there was some fate, but that man also had the wherewithal to change things in life. So, anyway, Josephus felt that he was going to be part of the Pharisees. And he brings this out in his writings. When he was a young man, this is how we know that Paul lived at the same time. He talks about when there was a man named Felix in Judea as a curator. He talks about priests of his acquaintance that were on trifling occasions put into bonds and sent to Rome to plead their cause before Caesar. Well, that's kind of what happened to Paul. And he goes on to say, he says, "These I was desirous to procure deliverance for, and that especially because I was informed that they were not unmindful of piety towards God, even under their afflictions, but supported themselves with figs and nuts. Accordingly, I came to Rome, though it were through a great number of hazards by sea, for as our ship was drowned in the Adriatic Sea, we that were in it, being about 600 in number, swam for our lives at night. When upon the appearance of the day, and upon our sight of a ship of Cyrene, I and some others, 80 in all, by God's providence, prevented the rest and were taken up into the other ship." Isn't that kind of neat? It's just what happened to Paul on his way to Rome. But Josephus went there. He might have been responsible, or God's way of releasing Paul at that particular time. He later came back and fought against Rome, was captured by Vespasian, and taken to Jerusalem, where he was asked to help Vespasian to convince the Jews to give up. The reason he was saved, or he wasn't killed right away by the Romans, was when he was brought as a prisoner into Vespasian. Vespasian talked to him, and Josephus had a vision that this Vespasian would become Caesar, and he told him, and Vespasian didn't believe it, but he thought, this man might have some kind of a vision from God, or might be a prophet. So he just put him in chains and kept him as a prisoner and started talking with him, and they became friends. So after the Jerusalem conquest, Vespasian was Caesar. So he brought Josephus with him to Rome, gave him his own apartment, subsidized him, so to speak, in anything that he wanted to do. Well, here's a nice Jewish boy that had studied the Torah, that knew history fantastically and loved it, had a true calling in that respect. Here he is in Rome, he has access to the wonderful libraries and wonderful books, and he wants to to explain to the Romans about his people, the Jews. So what does he do? He writes. And I thank God we still have the writings. We have writings where he writes his autobiography, where he writes about the wars of the Jews, and where he writes of the antiquities of the Jews. Now, like I said, he had access to many, many scrolls that no longer exist. He had access to historical records that no longer exist. But needless to say, none of the recorded history went back any further than that of the Egyptians, except the Torah that he had access to. So when he writes his history, he starts out with exactly the time that our Bible starts out, and he goes into the things that are exactly in our scripture up until the time of Abraham, which was at the time of the Egyptians. So this is the way his book one starts, of the antiquities of the Jews. It goes like this. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. But when the earth did not come into sight, but was covered with thick darkness, and a wind moved upon its surface, God commanded there should be light. And when that was made, he considered the whole mass, and separated the light and the darkness. And the name he gave to one was night, and the other he called day. He goes on like this, almost exactly like our Bible. His was actually the first translation, I think, from the Greek to the Latin, which was the vernacular of Rome. So basically what we have is a translation up until the time of Abraham, when he went to other records that they had at the time and gave other stories that may or may not be historically accurate, but they're interesting, very interesting nevertheless. No. In his translation of the Torah, it totally agrees with our copy of the Bible, except for some dates when children were born to Adam and his sons. For example, according to our Bible, Seth was born to Adam when Adam was 130 years old. Well, according to Josephus, Adam was 230 years old. It says that Enosh was born to Seth at 105, whereas Josephus says 205. And he almost adds 100 years to every person's age at the time of the child was born, which it adds up to a lot more than our record. According to you add them all up, and our Bible shows 1656 years between the time of Adam and Noah. According to Josephus, there are 2,256 years. There's another translation, luckily, that we still have of the Torah, which is called the Samaritan Bible. Now, when they have the genealogies, some of them agree with ours, some of them agree with Josephus's, but others aren't the same at all. It seems like the numbers were very hard to translate or to go into the new language. There's a reason that God has the numbers in our book that he does. But it's interesting to note that they may be different. From the time of Noah to Abraham, for example, our Bible has only 402 years. But according to Josephus, he has 993 years. And according to the Samaritan Pentateuch, or the Samaritan Bible, they have 952 years. It's just an interesting little sidelight. But to go on, when Josephus came in the time of history to Abraham, he had other sources and other books to go to. And some of them are really interesting, some of the additions. For example, here's where he talks about Abraham going into Egypt. "For whereas the Egyptians were formerly addicted to different customs and despised one another's sacred and accustomed rites and were very angry one with another on that account, Abram conferred with each of them, and confuting the reasonings they made use of, every one of their own practices demonstrated that such reasonings were vain and void of truth. Whereupon he was admired by them in those conferences as a very wise man, and one of great sagacity when he discoursed on any subject he undertook, and this not only in understanding it, but in persuading other men also to assent to it, he communicated to them arithmetic, and delivered to them the science of astronomy, for before Abram came into Egypt, they were unacquainted with those parts of learning. For that science came from the Chaldeans into Egypt, and from thence to the Greeks also." This is really interesting, and according to our book, where the Pharaoh of Egypt gave Abraham a lot of riches, our book says it was merely because Abraham lied to him, but this could be another reason why he was so well treated and given so many riches. He also elaborates a little bit on Abram's rescue of Lot when Lot was taken from Sodom. He said that Abram heard of the calamity of Lot being kidnapped, and he was at once afraid for Lot, his kinsman, and pitied the Sodomites, his friends and neighbors, and thinking it proper to afford them assistance, he did not delay it, but marched hastily. And the fifth night fell upon the Assyrians near Dan, for that's the name of the other spring of Jordan, and before they could arm themselves, he slew some as they were in their beds, before they could suspect any harm, and others who were not yet gone to sleep, but were so drunk they could not fight, ran away. Abram pursued after them till on the second day he drove them in a body into Hobah, a place belonging to Damascus, and demonstrated that victory does not depend on multitude and the number of hands, but the alacrity and courage of soldiers overcoming the most numerous bodies of men, while it gets the victory over so great an army with no more than 318 of his servants and 3 of his friends. So that kind of gives us an idea of the military tactics that Abram used when he conquered the Assyrians that had kidnapped Lot. He also goes on, and another little interesting addition, he says, "Now Abram dwelt near the oak, and now the place belongs to Canaan, not far from the city of Hebron. But being uneasy at his wife's barrenness, he entreated God to grant that he might have a male issue. And God required of him to be of good courage, and said that he would add to all the rest of the benefits that he had bestowed on him ever since he led him out of Mesopotamia, the gift of children. Now, accordingly, Sarai, at God's command, brought to his bed one of her handmaidens, a woman of Egyptian descent, in order to obtain children by her. And when this handmaid was with child, she triumphed and ventured to affront Sarai, as if the dominion were to come to a son to be born of her. Now, but when Abraham resigned her into the hand of Sarai to punish her, she contrived to fly away, as not able to bear the instances of Sarai's severity to her, and she entreated God to have compassion on her. And a divine angel met her as she was going forward into the wilderness, and bid her return to her master and mistress, for if she would submit to that wise advice, she would live better hereafter, for that the reason of her being in such a miserable case was this, that she had been ungrateful and arrogant towards her mistress. She also told the angel also told her that if she disobeyed God and went on still in her way, she should perish. But if she would return back, she should become the mother of a son who would reign over that country. These admonitions she obeyed and returned to her master and mistress, obtained forgiveness, and a little while afterwards she bare Ishmael, which may be interpreted, heard of God, because God heard his mother's prayer. So, many commentators say that Abraham went against the will of God when he went to Hagar. Yet, according to this, which is almost like one of the first commentaries on the Bible as well that we have written down, it said that it was all in God's will, and it was at God's command that Ishmael was born. Now, we can't make a dogma out of it, or we should. There's no way that I'm saying that this is 100% true, but it's just another way of looking at it, which I find interesting. Now, a few pages later, Josephus goes on to tell us the story of Abram sacrificing Isaac. And he also mentions that the place where Isaac was to be sacrificed was later on where the temple was built. He also tells us that Isaac was 25 years old when he was to be made the sacrifice, and that he went absolutely willingly. He puts these words into the mouth of Abraham when Abraham explains to Isaac what he's about to do. O son, I poured out a vast number of prayers that I might have thee for my son. When thou wast come into the world, there was nothing that could contribute to thy support for which I was not greatly solicitous, nor anything wherein I thought myself happier than to see thee grown up to man's estate, and that I might leave thee at my death the successor to my dominion. But since it was by God's will that I became thy father, and it is now his will that I relinquish thee, bear this consecration to God with a generous mind, for I resign thee up to God, who has thought fit now to require this testimony of honor to himself on account of the favors he hath conferred to me, in being to me a supporter and defender. Accordingly, thou, my son, wilt now die, not in any common way of going out of the world, but sent to God, the Father of all men beforehand, by thine own Father in the nature of a sacrifice. I suppose he thinks thee worthy to get clear of this world neither by disease, neither by war, nor by any other severe way by which death usually comes upon men, but so that he will receive thy soul with prayers and holy offices of religion, and will place thee near to himself, and thou wilt there be to me a succorer and supporter in my old age, on which account I principally brought thee up, and thou wilt thereby procure me God for my comforter instead of thyself. Wow, isn't that something that just parallels Jesus Christ, doesn't it? He goes on to say, now Isaac was of such a generous disposition as became the son of such a father, and was pleased with this discourse, and said that he was not worthy to be born at first if he should reject the determination of God and of his father, and should not resign himself up readily to both their pleasures, since it would have been unjust if he had not obeyed, even if his father alone had so resolved. So he went immediately to the altar to be sacrificed. Isn't that something? Isaac willingly went to the altar to be sacrificed. This is the kind of thing I dearly love that Josephus adds, and that we can parallel with Jesus Christ. It just fits, and it's so perfect. I love it. But probably the most interesting and the most that adds to our knowledge of the people in the Bible that Josephus talks about is about Moses. The whole story of Moses from the time that that he's born to the time that he goes to rescue the people of Israel out of Egypt in our Bible takes up maybe three or four paragraphs. Whereas in Josephus, he goes on many pages about Moses' being a general of the Egyptians and so forth that I really find is so worth reading that I'd like to read the whole thing. It'll take some time, but I hope you're as blessed by it as I was. The narrative starts after Joseph is dead and when a new Pharaoh came over the Egyptians, and all our Bible says is that this Pharaoh did not know Joseph. And here's what Josephus says. Now it happened that the Egyptians grew delicate and lazy and gave themselves up to other pleasures and in particular to the love of gain. They also became very ill affected towards the Hebrews as touched with envy at their prosperity. For when they saw how the nation of the Israelites flourished and were become eminent already in plenty of wealth, which they had acquired by their virtue and natural love of labor, isn't that real Jewish? They thought their increase was to their own detriment, in other words, Egyptian detriment, and having in length of time forgotten the benefits they had received from Joseph, particularly the crown being now come into another family, they became very abusive to the Israelites and contrived many ways of afflicting them. For they enjoined them to cut a great number of channels for the river, to build walls for their cities and ramparts that they might restrain the river and hinder its waters from stagnating upon its running over its own banks. They also set them to build pyramids, and by all this wore them out and forced them to learn all sorts of mechanical arts and to accustom themselves to hard labor. And 400 years did they spend under these afflictions, for they strove one against the other which could get the mastery. The Egyptians desiring to destroy the Israelites by these labors, and the Israelites desiring to hold out to the end under them. Now while the affairs of the Hebrews were in this condition, there was this occasion offered itself to the Egyptians which made them more solicitous for the extinction of our nation. One of those sacred scribes who are very sagacious in foretelling future events told the king that about this time there would be a child born to the Israelites, who, if he were reared, would bring the Egyptian dominion low and would raise the Israelites, that he would excel all men in virtue and obtain a glory that would be remembered through all ages. Which thing was so feared by the king that according to this man's opinion, he commanded that they should cast every male child which was born to the Israelites into the river and destroy it. That besides this, the Egyptian midwives should watch the labors of the Hebrew women and observe what is born. For those were the women who were enjoined to do the office of midwives to them, and by reason of their relation to the king, would not transgress his commands. He enjoined them also that if any parents should disobey him and venture to save their male children alive, they and their families should be destroyed. Now, see, in our Bible, it simply says that the Pharaoh gave that order because the children of Israel were growing to too great a multitude. But Josephus here, kind of almost in a parallel to the birth of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, said that the reason that they were killed, and it might be a combination of the two, was that a scribe or a fortune teller told Pharaoh that there would be a child born that would deliver the Israelites, and he would be really, really great. To go on. A man whose name was Amram, one of the nobler sort of the Hebrews, was afraid for his whole nation lest it should fail by the want of young men to be brought up hereafter, and was very uneasy at it. his wife being then with child, and he knew not what to do. Hereupon he betook himself to prayer to God, and entreated him to have compassion on those men who had no wise transgressed the laws of his worship, and to afford them deliverance from the miseries they at that time endured, and to render abortive their enemies' hopes of the destruction of their nation. Accordingly, God had mercy upon him, and was moved by his supplication. He stood by him in his sleep, and exhorted him not to despair of his future favors. He said further that he did not forget their piety towards him, and would always reward them for it, as he had formerly granted his favor to their forefathers. He also told him that, I shall provide for you all in common what is good for your good, and particularly for thyself what shall make thee famous. For that child, out of dread of whose nativity the Egyptians have doomed the Israelite children to destruction, shall be this child of thine, and shall be concealed from those who would watch to destroy him. And when he is brought up in a surprising way, he shall deliver the Hebrew nation from the distress they are under from the Egyptians. His memory shall be famous as long as the world lasts, and this not only among the Hebrews, but foreigners also, all of which shall be the effect of my favor to thee and to thy posterity. He shall also have such a brother that he shall himself obtain my priesthood, and his posterity shall have it after him to the end of the world. He goes on and gives an account of Moses being born, and then how they nourished the child privately for 3 months and put together the ark and the bulrushes, put the infant into it, set it afloat, and how Miriam, Moses' sister, passed along upon the bank. And the only thing that he really adds was the name of the Pharaoh's daughter, which according to him was Thermuthis. And this Thermuthis was then diverting herself by the banks of the river, and finds the cradle, and then gets Moses' mother, of course, to suckle the child. And this is where we'll take up about how the boy was raised. And Josephus goes on like this. For Moses was the son of Amram, who was the son of Caeth, whose father Levi was the son of Jacob, who was the son of Isaac, who was the son of Abraham. Now Moses' understanding became superior to his age, nay, far beyond that standard. And when he was taught, he discovered greater quickness of apprehension than was usual at his age. And his actions at that time promised greater when he should come to the age of a man. God did also give him that tallness when he was but 3 years old, as was wonderful. And for his beauty there was nobody so unpolite as, when they saw Moses, they were not greatly surprised at the beauty of his countenance. Nay, it happened frequently that those that met him as he was carried along the road were obliged to turn again upon seeing the child, that they left what they were about and stood still a great while to look on him. For the beauty of the child was so remarkable and natural to him on many accounts that it detained the spectators and made them stay longer to look upon him. Now see, none of this would be brought up in our Bible, because it says that Moses was the humblest man on earth at the time. Now he wouldn't talk about this when he was telling about himself, would he? Thermuthis, therefore, perceiving him to be so remarkable a child, adopted him for her son, having no child of her own. And when one time she carried Moses to her father, she showed to him and said she thought to make him her father's successor, if it should please God she should have no legitimate child of her own, and said to him, I have brought up a child who is of a divine form and of a generous mind, and as I have received him from the bounty of the river in a wonderful manner, I thought proper to adopt him for my son and the heir of thy kingdom. And when she had said this, she put the infant into her father's hand. So he took him and hugged him close to his breast, and on his daughter's account, in a pleasant way, put his crown upon his head. But Moses threw it down to the ground, and in a puerile mood he wreathed it round and trod upon it with his feet, which seemed to bring along with it an evil presage concerning the kingdom of Egypt. But when the sacred scribe saw this, he was the same person who had foretold that his nativity would bring the dominion of that kingdom low. He made a violent attempt to kill Moses, and crying out in a frightful manner, he said, "This, O king, this child is he of whom God foretold that if we kill him, we shall be in no danger. He himself affords an attestation to the prediction of the same thing by his trampling upon thy government and treading upon thy crown. Take him, therefore, out of the way, and deliver the Egyptians from the fear they are in about him, and deprive the Hebrews of the hope they have of being encouraged by him." He's talking about their own God. But Thermuthis prevented him and snatched the child away, and the king was not hasty to slay him. Our God himself, whose providence protected Moses, inclining the king to spare him. He was therefore educated with great care. So the Hebrews depended on him and were of good hopes that great things would be done by him. But the Egyptians were suspicious of what would follow such his education. Yet because if Moses had been slain, there was no one, either akin or adopted, that had any oracle on his side for pretending to the crown of Egypt, and likely to be of greater advantage to them, they abstained from killing him. Moses, therefore, when he was born, and brought up in the foregoing manner, and came to the age of maturity, made his virtue manifest to the Egyptians, and showed that he was born for the bringing them down and raising the Israelites. And the occasion he laid hold of was this. The Ethiopians, who are next neighbors to the Egyptians, made an inroad into their country, which they seized upon and carried off the effects of the Egyptians, who in their rage fought against them and revenged the affronts they had received from them. But being overcome in battle, some of them were slain, and the rest ran away in a shameful manner, and by that means saved themselves. Whereupon the Ethiopians followed them in the pursuit, and thinking that it would be a mark of cowardice if they did not subdue all Egypt, they went on to subdue the rest with great vehemence. And when they had tasted the sweets of the country, they never left off the persecution of the war. And as the nearest parts had not courage enough at first to fight with them, they proceeded as far as Memphis and the sea itself, while not one of the cities was able to oppose them. The Egyptians, under this sad oppression, betook themselves to their oracles and prophecies, and when God had given them this counsel to make use of Moses, the Hebrew, and take his assistance, the king commanded his daughter to produce him that he might be the general of their army. Upon which, when she had made him swear he would do him no harm, she delivered Moses to the king, and supposed his assistance would be a great advantage to them. She withal reproached the priest, who, when they had before admonished the Egyptians to kill him, was not ashamed now to own their want of his help. So Moses, at the persuasion both of Thermuthis and the Pharaoh himself, cheerfully undertook the business, and the sacred scribes of both nations were glad. Those of the Egyptians, that they should at once overcome their enemies by his valor, and that by the same piece of management Moses would be slain. But those of the Hebrews, that they should escape from the Egyptians, because Moses was to be their general. That Moses prevented the enemies, and took and led his army before those enemies were apprised of his attacking them, for he did not march by the river, but by land, where he gave a wonderful demonstration of his wisdom. For when the ground was difficult to be passed over because of a multitude of serpents, which it produces in vast numbers, and indeed is singular in some of those productions which other countries do not breed, and yet such as are worse than others in power and mischief, and in unusual fierceness of sight, some of which ascend out of the ground unseen, and jump in the air, and come upon men unawares, and do the mischief. Moses invented a wonderful strategy to preserve the army safe and without hurt from the snakes. He made baskets like unto arks of sedge and filled them with ibs, which is an animal that eats snakes, and carried them along with them. This animal is the greatest enemy to serpents imaginable, for they fly from them when they come near them, and as they fly they are caught and devoured from them by them, as if it were done by the harts. But the ibs are tame creatures and only enemies to the serpents. As soon, therefore, as Moses was come to the land, which was the breeder of these serpents, he let loose the ibs, and by their means repelled the serpents, and used them for his assistance before the army came upon that ground. When he had therefore proceeded thus on his journey, he came upon the Ethiopians before they expected him, and joining battle with them, he beat them and deprived them of the hopes they had of success against the Egyptians, and went on overthrowing their cities, and indeed made a great slaughter of these Ethiopians. Now when the Egyptian army had once tasted of this prosperous success by the means of Moses, they did not slacken their diligence, insomuch that the Ethiopians were in danger of being reduced to slavery and all sorts of destruction, and at length they retired to Saba, which is the royal city of Ethiopia, which Cambyses afterwards named Meru, after the name of his own sister. The place was to be besieged with very great difficulty, since it was both encompassed by the Nile and the other rivers, and made it a very difficult thing for such as attempted to pass over them. For the city was in a high place and was inhabited after the manner of an island, being encompassed with a strong wall, and having the rivers to guard them from their enemies, having great ramparts and rivers, insomuch that when the waters came with the greatest violence, can never be drowned. However, while Moses was uneasy at the armies lying idle, for the enemies durst not come to battle, this accident happened. Tharbas was the daughter of the king of the Ethiopians. She happened to see Moses as he led the army near the walls, and fought with great courage. And admiring the subtlety of his undertakings, and believing him to be the author of the Egyptian success, when they had before despaired of recovering their liberty, and to be the occasion of the great danger the Ethiopians were in, when they had before boasted of their great achievements, she fell deeply in love with him, and upon the prevalency of that passion, sent to him the most faithful of all her servants to discourse with him about their marriage. Moses thereupon accepted the offer on condition she would procure the delivering up of the city, and gave her the insurance of an oath to take her to his wife, and that when he had once taken possession of the city, he would not break his oath to her. No sooner was the agreement made, but it took effect immediately, and when Moses had cut off the Ethiopians, he gave thanks to God, consummated his marriage, and led the Egyptians back to their own land. Now the Egyptians, after they had been preserved by Moses, entertained a hatred to him, and were very eager in compassing their designs against him, as suspecting that he would take occasion from his good success to raise a sedition and bring innovations against Egypt, and told the king he should be slain. The king had also some intentions of himself to the same purpose, and this as well out of envy at the glorious expedition at the head of his army, as out of fear of being brought low by him, and being instigated by the sacred scribes, he was ready to undertake to kill Moses. But when he had learned beforehand what plots there were against him, he went away privately, that is Moses, and because the public roads were watched, he took his flight through the deserts, and where his enemies could not suspect he would travel. And though he was destitute of food, he went on and despised that difficulty courageously, came to the city of Midian. So there's the story according to Josephus, which is a little bit different than the version that we have, our version being that Moses killed one soldier and then the king forced him to leave the city. There's no reason why they can't both be true, that this killing of the soldier might have been the reason that the Pharaoh gave to try to kill Moses, but the real reason being what Josephus here told us. The next part that I really find interesting by Josephus is where he talks about the death of Moses. Now, in our Bible, it says that Moses went up on Mount Nebo, and where the Lord showed him the land of Canaan that the children of Israel were to have. And it says that Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in Moab, as the Lord had said. He buried him in Moab in the valley opposite Beth Peor, but to this day no one knows where his grave is. Moses was 120 years old when he died, yet his eyes were not weak, nor his strength gone. Later on, there's an interesting little sideline in Jude, where Jude says that the archangel Michael was disputing with the devil about the body of Moses. Rather interesting. Now, according to Josephus, Moses foretold prophecies about every one of the tribes, and then he blessed them. And then he says that he went to the place where he was to vanish out of their sight. All the people followed after him weeping, but Moses beckoned with his hand to those that were remote from him and bade them stay behind in quiet, while he exhorted those that were near to him that they would not render his departure so lamentable. Whereupon they thought they ought to grant him that favor to let him depart according as he himself desired. So they restrained themselves, though weeping still towards one another. And all those who accompanied him were the senate, Eleazar the high priest, and Joshua their commander. Now as soon as they were come to the mountain called Abarim, which is a very high mountain over against Jericho, and one that affords to such as are upon it a prospect of the greatest part of the excellent land of Canaan, he dismissed the senate, and as he was going to embrace Eleazar and Joshua, and was still discoursing with them, a cloud stood over him on the sudden, and he disappeared in a certain valley. Although he wrote in the holy books that he died, which was done out of fear lest they should venture to say that because of his extraordinary virtue he went to God. This again would seem to really verify again that Moses was a very humble man, in that he didn't want himself to be worshipped or adored because of his going to God, like Enoch did. The rest of Josephus, when he goes through David and Solomon and so forth, are extremely interesting, but they're not any significant way different than what we have in our Bible. He does add a lot of conversations and things like that that may have been in books, or maybe he made them up. We really don't know. He does kind of put in a little disclaimer when he comes to Daniel, when he writes this: "But let no one blame me for writing down everything of this nature as I find it in our ancient books. For as to that matter, I have plainly assured those that think me defective in any such point or complain of my management, and have told them in the beginning of this history," here, "that I intended to do no more than translate the Hebrew books into the Greek language, and promise them to explain those facts without adding anything to them of my own or taking anything away from them." This little disclaimer he put in because he had translated the book of Daniel, which talks about the golden idol that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and about the prophecy of Daniel concerning specifically the Roman Empire. And since he was translating for the Roman Empire, he had to put in this disclaimer because it says some interesting things about the Roman Empire. And it was interesting that he said he only translated from the Hebrew the books that they had, because he doesn't go into the book of Herodotus, where he describes how Cyrus overcame the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar, Balthazar, by blocking off the Nile and opening the doors. But he does give the story, like in our Bible, with the writing on the handwriting on the wall and the Medes and Persians coming in. Another little interesting addendum that he has is he says that Cyrus took Daniel the prophet and carried him with him into Media and honored him very greatly and kept him with him. For he was one of the three presidents whom he set over his 360 provinces, for into so many did Darius part them. Because at that particular time there was a very interesting man alive by the name of Zoroaster. And Zoroaster, traditionally and historically, was the founder of the Magi, which are astronomers, and they started their own religion. But it's interesting that it was at the same time. Also at this particular time, in India, there was a certain man named Buddha that was alive. Also Confucius, also Lao Tse, who wrote the Tao. They were all alive at this particular time. It's almost like God allowed a lot of satanic influences at the time, because there was no temple. The canon of the Hindus was also completed about this time. So all of the religions that exist that don't have a biblical base today were founded right during the time when the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, and the time when Cyrus defeated the Babylonian kingdom. He also talked about the Roman philosophy a bit, but he kind of put it in the way of a commentary on Daniel, where he said, in the very same manner, Daniel also wrote concerning the Roman government, and that our country should be made desolate by them. All these things did this man leave in writing, as God had showed them to him, insomuch that such as read his prophecies and see how they have been fulfilled would wonder at the honor wherewith God honored Daniel, and may thence discover how the Epicureans are in an error, who cast providence out of human life, or predetermination, and do not believe that God takes care of the affairs of the world, nor that the universe is governed and continued in being by that blessed and immortal nature, but say that the world is carried along of its own accord, without a ruler and a curator, which, were it destitute of a guide to conduct, as they imagine, it would be like ships without pilots, which we see drowned by the winds, or like chariots without drivers, which are overturned. So would the world be dashed to pieces by its being carried without a providence, and so perish and come to naught, so that by the forementioned predictions of Daniel, those men seem to me very much to err from the truth, who determine that God exercises no providence over human affairs. For if that were the case, that the world went on by mechanical necessity, we should not see that all things would come to pass according to his prophecy. Now, as to myself, I have so described these manners as I have found them and read them. But if anyone is inclined to another opinion about them, let him enjoy his different sentiments without any blame from me. And personally, that sounds to me like the evolutionist, doesn't it? That the world goes on by mechanical necessity, that there's no providence, that God has no share in the world, and it's all nonsense. But almost 2,000 years ago, here's a man that says, if someone is inclined to that opinion, Let him enjoy those sentiments without any blame from me. Now, going on historically, we have, of course, the rebuilding of the temple by Ezra 70 years later. And there's an interesting little difference in the translation from the Hebrew to the Greek. The difference being in our Bible that the punishment for interfering with the building of the temple would be that the person that interferes would be hung on a beam that's to be pulled from his house, and he is to be lifted up and impaled on it. Whereas Josephus translates it that whoever disobeyed these injunctions shall be hung upon a cross and their substance brought into the king's treasury. I found it rather interesting that the rebuilding of Solomon's temple should be made with a threat of hanging on a cross, where when the necessity of having the temple should be removed by Jesus dying on the cross over 500 years later. Now let's skip ahead a couple of hundred years, almost 200 years, and check into something that's kind of in between the Old Testament and the New Testament concerning Jerusalem. You recall when there was a woman at the well that asked Jesus where the Samaritans were supposed to worship, whether on Mount Gerizim or in Jerusalem at the temple. It's interesting that Josephus would talk about the beginning of that particular temple, and it was also an occasion for Alexander the Great to come into Jerusalem. He writes that the elders of Jerusalem were very uneasy that the brother of Jaddua, the high priest, though married to a foreigner, should be a partner with him in the high priesthood. So they quarreled, because they esteemed this man's marriage a step to such as would be desirous of transgressions about the marriage of strange wives, and that this would be the beginning of a mutual society with foreigners. Although the offense of some about marriages and their having married wives that were not of their own country has been an occasion of their former captivity and of the miseries they then underwent. So they commanded this Manasseh to divorce his wife or not to approach the altar. The high priest himself joining with the people in their indignation against his brother and driving him away from the altar. Whereupon Manasseh came to his father-in-law, Sanballat, and told him that although he loved his daughter Nicaso, yet was he not willing to be deprived of his sacerdotal dignity on her account, which was the principal dignity in their nation and always continued in the same family. So Sanballat promised him not only to preserve to him the honor of his priesthood, but to procure for him the power and dignity of a high priest and would make him governor of all the places he himself now ruled if he would keep his daughter for his wife. He also told him further that he would build him a temple like that at Jerusalem upon Mount Gerizim, which is the highest of all the mountains that are in Samaria, and he promised that he would do this with the approbation of Darius the king. And now Manasseh was elevated with these promises and stayed with his father-in-law, Sanballat, upon a supposal that he should gain the high priesthood as bestowed upon him by Darius, for it happened Sanballat was then very old. But there was now a great disturbance among the people of Jerusalem, because many of those priests and Levites were entangled in such matches, for they all revolted to Manasseh, and Sanballat afforded them money and divided among them land for tillage and habitations also, and all this in order every way to gratify his son-in-law. And about this time it was that Darius heard how Alexander had passed over the Hellespont, had beaten his lieutenants in the Battle of Granicum, and was proceeding further. Whereupon he gathered together an army of horse and foot and determined that he would meet the Macedonians before they should assault and conquer all Asia. So Darius passed over the river Euphrates and came upon Taurus, and at Cilicia he waited for the enemy, as ready there to give him battle, upon which Sanballat was glad that Darius was come down, and told Manasseh that he would suddenly perform his promises to him, and this as soon as ever Darius should come back after he had beaten his enemies. For not he only, but all those that were in Asia also were persuaded that the Macedonians would not so much as come to a battle with the Persians on account of their multitude. But the events proved otherwise than they expected, for the king joined battle with the Macedonians and was beaten and lost a great part of his army. His mother also and his wife and children were taken captives, and he fled into Persia. So Alexander came into Syria and took Damascus. And when he obtained Sidon, he besieged Tyre, when he sent an epistle to the Jewish high priest, asking him to send him some auxiliaries and to supply his army with provisions, and that what presents he formerly sent to Darius, he would now send to him, and choose the friendship of the Macedonians, and that he should never repent of so doing. But the high priest answered the messengers that he had given his oath to Darius not to bear arms against Darius, and he said that he would not transgress this while Darius was in the land of the living. Upon hearing this answer, Alexander was very angry, and though he determined not to leave Tyre, which was just ready to be taken, yet as soon as he had taken it, he threatened that he would make an expedition against the Jewish high priest, and through him teach all men to whom they must keep their oaths. So when he had taken Tyre and settled its affairs, he came to the city of Gaza and besieged both the city and him that was governor. But Sanballat thought he had now gotten a proper opportunity to make his attempt, so he renounced Darius. Taking with him 7,000 of his subjects, he came to Alexander. Finding him beginning the siege of Tyre, he said to him that he delivered up to him these men who came out of places under his dominion, and did gladly accept of him for their lord instead of Darius. So when Alexander received him kindly, Sanballat took courage and spake to him about his present affair, told him about his son-in-law Manasseh, brother to the high priest Jaddua, and that there were many others of his nation now with him that were desirous to have a temple in the places subject to him, that it would be for the king's advantage to have the strength of the Jews divided into two parts, lest when the nation is of one mind and united upon any attempt for innovation, it prove troublesome to kings, as it had formerly proved to the kings of Assyria. Whereupon Alexander gave Sanballat leave so to do, who used the utmost diligence and built the temple at Gerizim, and made Manasseh the priest, and deemed it a great reward that his daughter's children should have that dignity. But when the 7 months of the siege of Tyre were over, 2 months of the siege of Gaza, Sanballat died. Now Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, made haste to go up to Jerusalem. And Jaddua, the high priest, when he heard that, was in an agony and under terror, not knowing how he should meet the Macedonians, since the king was displeased at his foregoing disobedience. He therefore ordained that the people should make supplications and should join with him in offering sacrifices to God, whom he sought to protect that nation and to deliver them from the perils that were coming upon them. Whereupon God warned him in a dream, which came upon him after he had offered sacrifice, that he should take courage and adorn the city and open the gates, that the rest should appear in white garments, but that he and the priests should meet the king in the habits proper to their order, without the dread of any ill consequences which the providence of God would prevent. Upon which, when the high priest rose from his sleep, he greatly rejoiced and declared to all the warning he had received from God, according to which dreams he acted entirely, and so waited for the coming of the king. And when he understood that he was not far from the city, he went out in procession with the priests and the multitude of citizens. The procession was venerable, and the manner of it different from that of other nations. It reached to a place called Safa, which name translated into Greek signifies a prospect, for you then have a prospect or a view both of Jerusalem and of the temple. And when the Phoenicians and the Chaldeans that followed him thought they should have liberty to plunder the city and torment the high priest to death, which the king's displeasure fairly promised them, the very reverse happened. For, this is the interesting part, Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance in white garments, while the priests stood clothed with fine linen, and the high priest in purple and scarlet clothing, with his mitre on his head, having the golden plate whereon the name of God was engraved, he approached him by himself and adored that name, and first saluted the high priest. The Jews also did all together with one voice salute Alexander and encompass him about, whereupon the kings of Syria and the rest were surprised at what Alexander had done, and supposed him disordered in his mind. However, Parmenio alone went up to him and asked him how it came to pass that when all others adored him, he should adore the high priest of the Jews. To whom Alexander replied, I did not adore him, but that God who hath honored him with his high priesthood. For I saw this very person in a dream, in this very habit, when I was at Dios in Macedonia, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea thither, for that he would conduct my army, and would give me the dominion over the Persians. Whence it is that having seen no other in that habit, and now seeing this person in it, and remembering that vision, and the exhortation which I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army under the divine conduct, and shall therewith conquer Darius and destroy the power of the Persians, and that all things will succeed according to what is in my own mind. And when he had said this to Parmenio, and had given the high priest his right hand, the priests ran along by him, and he came into the city. And when he went up into the temple, he offered sacrifices, that Alexander offered sacrifice to God according to the high priest's direction, and magnificently treated both the high priest and the priests. And when the book of Daniel was showed to him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians, he supposed that he himself was the person intended, and as he was then glad, he dismissed the multitude for the present. But the next day he called to him and bade them ask what favors they pleased of him. Whereupon the high priest desired that they might enjoy the laws of their forefathers and might pay no tribute on the seventh year. He granted all they desired, and when they entreated him that he would permit the Jews in Babylon and Media to enjoy their own laws also, he willingly promised to do hereafter what they desired. And when he said to the multitude that if any of them would enlist themselves in his army on this condition, that they should continue under the laws of their forefathers and live according to them, he was willing to take with them many were ready to accompany him in his wars. And now he goes on, and there's a little insight into why the Jews hated the Samaritans. So when Alexander had thus settled matters at Jerusalem, he led his army into the neighboring cities. And when all the inhabitants to whom he came received him with great kindness, the Samaritans, who had then Shechem for their metropolis, a city situate at Mount Gerizim and inhabited by apostates of the Jewish nation, seeing that Alexander had so greatly honored the Jews, determined to profess themselves Jews. For such is the disposition of the Samaritans, as we have already elsewhere declared, that when the Jews are in adversity, they deny that they are of kin to them, and then they confess the truth. But when they perceive that some good fortune hath befallen them, they immediately pretend to have communion with them, saying that they belong to the posterity of Josephus, Ephraim, and Manasseh. Accordingly, they made their address to the king with splendor and showed great alacrity in meeting him at a little distance from Jerusalem. And when Alexander had commended them, the Shechemites approached to him, taking with them the troops that Sanballat had sent him, and they desired that he would come to their city and do honor to their temple also, to whom he promised that when he returned he would come to them, and when they petitioned that he would remit the tribute of the seventh year to them, because they did not now sow thereon, he asked who they were that made such a petition. And when they said that they were Hebrews, but had the name of Sidonians, living at Shechem, he asked them again whether they were Jews. And when they said they were not Jews, it was to the Jews, said he, that I granted that privilege. However, when I return and am thoroughly informed by you of this matter, I will do what I shall think proper. So you kind of have a reason why the Jews hated the Samaritans. And when Jesus tried to make a point of a really lowly person that would help a man that's knocked down, as in the story of the Good Samaritan, when he said, when he used the term Samaritan, it was like us using a drug dealer or a pornographer or something, something really awful. He goes on to say that when Alexander was dead, the government was parted among his successors, of course, but the temple upon Mount Gerizim remained. And if anyone were accused by those of Jerusalem of having eaten things common or unclean, or of having broken the Sabbath, or of any other crime of the like nature, he fled away to the Shechemites and said that he was accused unjustly. About this time it was that Jaddua the high priest died, and this was the state of the affairs of Jerusalem at this time. So we have another reason why they hate the Samaritans, because all of the outcasts and all of the people that didn't follow the rules of the temple would take off for there and would naturally live there. Our Bible does not talk about the Maccabees, which Josephus does. And we have several books on the Maccabees that are existent. In fact, the Catholic Church uses 1st and 2nd Maccabees as part of their canon, but we don't. Most of us aren't really familiar with Judas Maccabeus and all of that, but that's all covered by Josephus in great detail. And I would suggest that you read it yourself. It's a little bit lengthy and boring to put on tape. The next part that I found interesting enough to go into from Josephus is the story of Herod. Herod the Great. The story of Herod really begins with two priests of Jerusalem called Aristobulus and Hyrcanus, who were fighting about which one would be the high priest. And Hyrcanus, who was the older brother and by rights entitled to the high priesthood, was rather an easygoing guy that didn't really push and wanted to take life easy, where his brother was one of those really pushy guys that wanted to take over and control things. So the younger brother usurped the high priesthood, so to speak, from his older brother Hyrcanus, and Hyrcanus really didn't mind, except for some people were trying to get him to maintain the high priesthood for their own purposes, really, because whoever liked Hyrcanus didn't like Aristobulus and vice versa. But there was one especially that tried to prompt or push Hyrcanus into taking over from his brother, and this person was an Idumean, or a person from a person that's descended from Esau. Remember, Jacob's brother. And this man was called Antipater, who was very rich, and in his nature an active and seditious man, who was at enmity with Aristobulus, and had differences with him on account of his goodwill to Hyrcanus. So their battle between the two of them, between Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, was fueled, so to speak, by this guy named Antipater. And to try to help solve the problem, they sent to Rome, which was the big power at the time, specifically a man called Pompey. Now, all of you that remember your history books, Pompey was a man that was with Julius Caesar. The two of them ruled more or less the Roman Empire. So they sent for Pompey and asked him to settle the affairs between Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. Now, Aristobulus pulled some little deals that got Pompey angry, and Hyrcanus helped Pompey. So when Pompey came and took over Jerusalem, he also went into the temple, saw all the things that they weren't supposed to see. In other words, they desecrated it, really. But he didn't touch anything. He just went in and looked at it. Then he restored the high priesthood to Hyrcanus, made Jerusalem tributary to the Romans, and carried bound along with him Aristobulus and his children. So Hyrcanus was in effect the high priest and the ruler of Jerusalem, pretty much thanks to this guy Antipater. Now, Antipater made friends with Pompey and helped him in several wars and expeditions, furnished him corn out of Judea and whatever else he wanted, and this at the command of Hyrcanus. And so Antipater kind of ingratiated himself with Pompey. Now, even though Antipater was friends with Pompey, we all know that Caesar was victorious over Pompey, and after Pompey was dead, Josephus tells us that Antipater, who managed the Jewish affairs, became very useful to Caesar, and he commended Antipater and made use of him all the rest of that war in the most hazardous undertakings, and Antipater also happened to be wounded in one of those engagements. However, when Caesar, after some time, had finished the war and was sailing away for Syria, he honored Antipater greatly and confirmed Hyrcanus in the high priesthood, and he bestowed on Antipater the privilege of a citizen of Rome and a freedom from taxes everywhere. Now, this Antipater married another Idumean named Cypros, by whom he had four sons, Phasael and Herod, who was afterwards made king, and Joseph and Pheroras, and a daughter named Salome. Caesar appointed Hyrcanus to be high priest and gave Antipater what principality he himself should choose, leaving the determination to himself. So he made him procurator of Judea. And seeing that Hyrcanus was of a slow and slothful temper, he made Phasaelus, his eldest son, governor of Jerusalem and of the places that were about it, but committed Galilee to Herod, his next son, who was then a very young man, for he was but 25 years of age. But that youth of his was no impediment to him. But as he was a youth of great mind, he presently met with an opportunity of signalizing his courage. For finding there was one Hezekiah, a captain of a band of robbers, who overran the neighboring ports of Syria, he seized him and slew him, as well as a great number of other robbers, for which action he was greatly beloved by the Syrians. But now the principal men among the Jews, when they saw Antipater and his sons grow so much in the goodwill of the nation, and in the revenues which they received out of Judea and out of Hyrcanus' own wealth, they became ill-disposed to him. For Antipater had contracted a friendship with the Roman emperors, and when he had prevailed with Hyrcanus to send them money, he took it to himself and presented the intended and sent it to him as if it were his own and not Hyrcanus's gift. Hyrcanus heard of this management. He didn't care. He was rather glad of it. But the chief men of the Jews were therefore in fear, because they saw that Herod was a violent and bold man and very desirous of acting tyrannically. So they came to Hyrcanus and accused Antipater and said to him, "How long wilt thou be quiet under such actions? Don't you see what Antipater and his sons have already seized upon the government, and that's only the name of the king which is given thee? And furthermore, Herod, Antipater's son, hath slain Hezekiah and those that were with him, and hath thereby transgressed our law, which hath forbidden to slay any man, even though he were a wicked man, unless he had first been condemned to suffer death by the Sanhedrin. Yet hath he been so insolent as to do this, and that without any authority from thee." Hyrcanus was so moved by these complaints, he summoned Herod to come to trial for what was charged of him. Now, Herod came, but his father had persuaded him to come not like a private man, but with a guard for the security of his person, and that when he had settled the affairs of Galilee in the best manner he could for his own advantage, he should come to his trial, but still with a body of men sufficient for his security on his journey. Yet he should not come with such great a force as might look like he would be terrifying Hyrcanus, because everyone, whoever he be, that comes to be tried by the Sanhedrin, presents himself in a submissive manner, and like one that is in fear for himself, and that endeavors to move the compassion, with his hair disheveled and in a black and mourning garment. But this admirable man Herod, who was accused of murder and called to answer so heavy an accusation, stood there clothed in purple and with his head finely trimmed and his armed men about him, that if the Sanhedrin should condemn him by the law, he may slay him, and by overbearing justice may himself escape death. So Herod was supposed to be tried by the Sanhedrin for a crime. Does that kind of bring back memories of Jesus our Christ? When Jesus came, although he was king of the Jews, rightful king of the Jews, he didn't lift a hand. He did not say anything to defend himself. He came meek, humble, like a lamb. But Herod, who usurped the government, was also tried by the Sanhedrin. And how did he come in there? He came in there with his military, with all of his might and grandeur, dressed in purple and his hair shining, and he just dared them to convict him. They did find him not guilty, but later he never forgot it. When Herod had received the kingdom, he slew all the members of this Sanhedrin, and Hyrcanus too, excepting Semaeus, for he had a great honor for him on account of his righteousness. And because when the city was afterwards besieged by Herod, he persuaded the people to admit Herod into it, and told them that for their sins they would not be able to escape his hands. This Herod is so interesting. We're almost out of time, but to read Josephus and to find out what a man this Herod was. He was the epitome of a fleshly man. He was big for his time. He was brave, brash. He was the all-American man, so to speak. And even people like Mark Antony admired him. People like Cleopatra made passes at him. And, well, of course, she might have been trying to steal his lands and so forth. But all of this is brought out in the rest of Josephus, and it's extremely interesting, and maybe next time we can go over that. So God bless you, and have a wonderful day.